called to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is April 13th, 2011, and we are convened for the purposes of work sessions on a number of bills, as well as public hearings and possible work sessions on some others. This is still a work in progress on how we're going to proceed, but let me tell you what I do know for sure we're not going to be voting on today. We're still waiting on an amendment on 719, so that's not going to move today. 717 and 718, we're still waiting on an amendment on 718 and the fiscal on 717, so those are not going to move today. We may move 573. We will carry over 634. We may move 908. We may move 612. We will be rolling over 667. We may move 890 with the dash 6 amendments. We may move 944. We may move Senate Bill 163, depending on the discussion we have in committee. 957 is not ready. We will roll over Senate Bill 957. And then we have...
We're going to hear that, though.
Oh, yeah, we're still going to hear that, right. But it's not ready to go. We will have a hearing on 823 and 900, but those obviously will not be ready to go. We will be rolling over Senate Bill 41.
Postpone this to Ways and Means, or tax credit?
We're just having a hearing on that now. The subsequent referral will be later. Senator George asked if we were going to move 823 and 900 to subsequent referral to tax credits. We will potentially at some point, but not today. Senate Bill 41 is not ready, so we will roll that one over. We can move Senate Bill 240. I'm sorry, 294. We might move that today. We will be rolling over 329. We will be rolling over Senate Bill 491, and we will be rolling over 610. We will not be voting on 610 today, and we're waiting on an amendment, and I'm not quite sure the state of the negotiations between the parties on that, but hopefully there can be some resolution on a bill to go forward. Okay. That's Senator Jane Felder's bill.
She's here.
Okay. So we will I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 163, and Senator Dinkfelder will testify, and then we will get to the Attorney General and Senate Bill 957 shortly thereafter.
I didn't need to trump the Attorney General if you wanted to.
He knows who butters his bread.
Glad you said that, and I didn't. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder from Northeast, Southeast Portland and Maywood Park. I bring to you today Senate Bill 163, which is a fairly simple, short bill, as you can read very well for yourself. And what it does is it just changes how the Marine Board Director is appointed. Right now, it's currently appointed by the Marine Board, and this would make the appointment by the governor. You may know that I sit on the Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. Your hearing is almost as busy as my hearings are. I sit on the Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee and review the budgets of 14 different natural resource agencies. What we have in the state is a mishmash of systems. We have some of those agencies where the director is appointed by the commission. We have some of those agencies where the director is appointed by the governor. And we have varying degrees of accountability, frankly, among those boards and commissions because of that. I just want to make it clear, I don't have a personal vendetta against the Oregon State Marine Board. I think they perform some very valuable services. They increase boater safety. They provide public education on a variety of water-related topics. They maintain access to our waterways and an enhanced environment. And as an example of its vital work, in 2009, we passed a bill to create the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program, and the Marine Board is one of the lead agencies in administering this program. It was disheartening to learn about an audit that was conducted last year by the Secretary of State. Some of you may have seen it. Financially, it was not a huge amount of money, but there were some fairly egregious practices in there by the former director. The new director is working on remedying that, and you may hear from him today, and I think he's doing a very good job. However, when I talked to the governor's office last session about some of these problems that were occurring, because the director had been there for over 20 years, the answer from the governor's office was, we can do nothing about it. And I found that very hard to believe, but because he did not appoint the director, the board did. He would, in essence, it would be an act of the board to change that. So many other agency director positions are appointed by the governor. This bill would simply switch that. I think when we're talking about greater accountability by this body, greater transparency, I think this is a wise move. I'm sure you will hear that there are no general funds that go to this agency. Well, it's still a state agency, and we are still responsible for reviewing their budgets and making sure that programs are operated wisely and that these dollars, even though they are not tax dollars, they are fee dollars, are spent wisely. As I mentioned on the Ways and Means Natural Resources Committee, one of the things that I've observed in the 8 years that I've sat on that is we are funding these agencies with less and less general fund. The general fund for our natural resource programs are dwindling. It's less than 1% of the general fund. That means we're relying more and more heavily on fees, on federal funds, and on other funds such as lottery funds. Does that mean because general funds aren't involved that we should not care about what these agencies are doing or be responsible for the programs and oversight of these programs in a responsible and transparent manner? So that is the concern I have. That's why this bill is before you. It's a fairly simple bill. Frankly, I think that all of our directors should be appointed by the governor so we have better checks and balances. Putting all of the power in one board or commission to make those decisions, I think, is unwise. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
No questions. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for hearing this bill. I know you're very busy. Somehow I didn't think everyone was here for this bill. So, thank you.
Could we bring up Scott Brewer? Bruin, please.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I just wanted to go on record today that we are neutral on the bill. I do not have any written testimony, but would be happy to answer any questions if you have those.
Okay. No questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. So this bill is ready to go. So I will, I'm interested in seeing if there's some discussion that we might want to have on this. Or
Marine Board.
No, we're still in public hearing.
Bill 163.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator
Bonamici.
Maybe Patrick knows, and maybe I should have asked Senator Dinkelder. What happens to the existing, when does this take effect? What happens to the existing director?
Let me just grab the bill. So, and again, this is State Senator Jackie Dinkelder, Senate District 23. The bill takes effect, the amendment, is to apply to appointments made on or after the effective date of this act. However, like many of the directors, this director would serve at the will of the governor, so it would be up to the governor. I would not recommend to the governor at this point to replace this current director because I think that he's doing a very good job. But what it does provide us is with the tools, so if there are malfeasance or problems in the future, that the governor has the flexibility to make that decision. And as I said, I was told by the previous governor that they had no say in that decision. And that's not uncommon with many. As I mentioned, only three of the natural resource agencies have governor appointees. That means a huge amount of the commissions are controlled by special interests on either side. So getting an agreement sometimes is very challenging. I do think that having the governor weigh in provides some checks and balances, as I mentioned before.
Senator George.
I should have never come back up.
Senator, I guess here's my, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I mean, I agree with you completely on the control that we have.
We are on the record.
Yeah, I know. I guess I should say as it relates to what you said about this bill. But I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, we have a problem with commissions, that they're independent, that they don't seem to really listen to us. They don't seem to listen to the governor once they're appointed. We got a problem with other funds. I mean, I opined about that issue quite a bit lately. I agree with you generally that we have a problem with commissions basically being run by boards, and I think it goes deeper than that. I think it goes down to the administrative rules. That in essence, we have gifted to unelected state boards the ability to write law that overrules and many times our laws that we pass in state statute. So I totally agree with you in kind of the direction you're headed. My problem with taking this particular bill forward is that I think you've hit a big, big issue with this one. Like, I think it's something that the legislature, now that we're in annual sessions, ought to take a full scope view of how we treat commissions and boards. And we shouldn't pick and choose, because kind of what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I could probably go along with a wholesale change of how we do commissions and boards and how we do all that and how we do administrative rule oversight. I don't really want to do it in a piece-by-piece method. I'd like to see the legislature take on a full scope, re-grabbing back and putting the legislature as an equal branch of government. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, why I'm not really supportive of this bill, because I think you've hit the right issue. It's just you're not nearly wide enough in your how far you threw the net.
And if I may respond, Mr. Chair, and I know you have a lot on your plate, so I don't want to derail you too much, but just to a couple of your points, and it's glad to know that we have some things in common once in a while, Senator, so it makes me very happy. But couple of things. First of all, one thing I've learned in my decade in the legislature is that as much as we would like to do things in a big, wide, sweeping scope, we tend to be incremental because that's what we can get done. So my sense is, one, this is a start. Two, I targeted a problem issue. I really don't want to say problem agency because there's a lot of good people in the agency, but a problem issue that couldn't be resolved, and part of it was wanting to raise awareness about that. Three, I did have a hearing, a public hearing in my committee, the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, about looking at consolidation of natural resources for the very issue that you talked about. And it was very interesting because many of the stakeholders that have been talking about streamlining with me and probably you for many years, when I put that bill out there, of course, they said, oh, no, that's not the way we're going to do it. So that sort of went over like a lead balloon. Doesn't mean that we can't work on that during the interim, which sounds like something you'd be interested in working on. However, I do believe this is a start. I do believe it sends a message to boards and commissions that we need to make sure that there's a balance. And I think it shows that we are responding to an agency that did have some issues with lack of oversight. And one of the things, again, this director is absolutely going in the right direction, but it took the audit to point that out, and these were practices that were going on for many years. And the board didn't know because the board was never trained when I asked the board members if they knew about this. Of course not, because you know, it was never brought before them. So I want to be fair to the people who are involved that they just didn't know that certain things were happening. And again, if you have a governor that is the executive branch that's overseeing these agencies, that has to be more involved because they're accountable to the governor in addition to the board and the people of Oregon. That's why I think that strikes a balance in this bill.
Thank you. Senator Bocas.
Thank you, Senator Dinkfelder. Governor Kulongoski is going to have an opportunity to make another decision for at least 8 years. And so where is Governor
Kitsap? We're a Kitsap. Oh, sorry.
Where is Governor Kitsap? That's exactly my point. So because you just made reference to previous governor, and for 8 more years he can't run, or at least this one, you know, might go on for a while, or maybe 4, we'll say, because you can't do more than 2 consecutive terms. But the question is the governor, I see nothing in here from the present governor. I haven't heard anything from the present governor's policy staff. Where's the present governor in this argument?
I cannot speak for the governor, obviously, but they have not, and I meet on a regular basis with his natural resource advisor, they have not told me that they are opposed to this bill. I would have assumed I would have heard from them if they had a problem with the bill. If anything, I think they would be supportive.
I can't miss this. Mr. Chair,
as long as you don't ask me about cougars, otherwise I'm leaving.
Governor hasn't said he's opposed to my dredging the Willamette Bill either.
Well, maybe not.
I hear he's got a big pen that he might be able to pull out if he does. So.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I know we're not in work session, but I'm disagreeing with the good senator to my right. I think this is a good start, but I also wanted to mention as a follow-up to the comment about agencies writing rules that are beyond the scope of the enabling statute that we have the Attorney General in the room and our legislative counsel. If that's happening, we should bring that to someone's attention because...
I've sued on it, and pretty much we're screwed.
Now I'm glad the Attorney General is following me because he can make sure and clean up for all of himself.
Yeah, well,
thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We've got the paperwork ready to go on this, and so we are at the point of the session where we're going to need to, as I said on Senate Bill 667 the other day, either decide or get off the pot. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 163. Senator Bonamici, would you make the motion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill, that we move Senate Bill 163 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici has moved Senate Bill 163 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Could you please call the roll, Debbie?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Borkfest?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shuler.
Aye. Motion passes, and this will be the first time Senator Dingfelder has had a bill on the floor that was not unanimous coming out of committee. So we'll we'll have Senator Dingfelder carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to serve notice of potential minority report.
Senator George has moved notice of a potential minority report. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 163, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 957, Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon, and I'm deeply appreciative of you taking a few minutes out for this bill. I know you've got an incredible agenda. The origins of Senate Bill 957 are very simple. In 2009, we began a process of trying to deliver legal services more efficiently at the Department of Justice, as well as cut our overhead. And when we reached the end of the 2009 calendar year, because that was successful, we had a budget surplus in our operating account of $3 million. Those monies that had come to the department for carrying out our missions that we did not need, primarily because we'd lowered our overhead expenses for the department. At that point, I wanted to return the money to the general fund and discovered that it is legally impossible for me to return money to the general fund I don't need, that it would require legislative action by the legislature to call the money back, that individual agencies don't have legal authority to return money that they've been appropriated, even if they do not need those funds to carry out their mission. And so this bill was designed to correct what I think is suboptimal in the way we're set up to operate. The bill simply says that if at any point in time during a biennium the Department of Justice has funds that it does not need to carry out the mission that it's been assigned by the legislature, we're able to return those money to the general fund. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Want to take a victory lap,
Senator George? I just want to notice that it took 152 years for anybody to notice that they couldn't send money back. So for 152 years, nobody tried to return any money. So I wonder why that happened. But we appreciate your efforts, Mr. Attorney General.
I have,
Senator Boquist.
Being a historian, I must come to the defense of the state of Oregon because this actually happened to me in a small tweak in a federal law. Was done in 1999 that we found out when the federal government overpays you, you can't give the money back. And that litigation started in 1776. So the federal government took even longer to figure out how to take money back.
Well, that's encouraging.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. We appreciate it. That bill has amendments in draft, I believe. And
we have a dash one.
Oh, we have it back?
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Members of the committee, the dash one amendment was
was the bill that the Attorney General was addressing. It's gotten stuff of the original bill, and we do not currently have the fiscal or revenue statements on that.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. I always have Patrick teed up first, and I forgot. I get in trouble when that happens.
All right. I don't know how he got in line in front of me, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 957, and we will roll that one over. And I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 823 and a public hearing on Senate Bill 900. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These two bills are identical. The two bills, Senate Bill 823 and Senate Bill 900, extend for an additional 6 years the sunset for tax credits for affordable housing lenders. The measure would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. We have received, as part of the materials, I believe we were sent the materials that Housing and Community Services will be presenting, so that should be in your packet. They may be providing those in hard copy to us. We also have received testimony in support of the two bills from the City of Eugene, Brenda Wilson. And I'd also sent around a memo from the chairs of the Joint Tax Credits Committee. That memo had a few issues that the committee, that they would like policy committees to address on all of the bills that have subsequent referrals to joint tax credits. In this particular case, for these two bills, the question before the questions that they would like to the committee to dwell on would be to review the goals or purposes of the credit, which I believe the agency is prepared to do, to evaluate the effectiveness of the credit in achieving its goals, to consider new credits for achieving the same policy goals, to prioritize credits based on evaluation. In this case, it's one credit, two bills, so that one doesn't apply. And then they would like the recommendations that they're looking for to decide on action, the simplest actions, which will probably be the case for our committee is to choose from among these. To the recommendation to extend the tax credit would be to move this bill to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. To extend with modifications would require amendment. To allow the credit to sunset would be to take no action on the measure, and then to replace existing credit with a new and more effective credit. I believe we probably don't have time to undertake designing a new tax credit at this point, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, Patrick. We're supposed to do this in the next 5 minutes.
We could take up to 20.
I sent this to you.
Rick Krager. Can Rick Krager please?
Patrick.
I'm with you. The fancy way to say it. Which one?
Back to us.
Welcome to the committee, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Krager, I'm the Acting Director for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you very much for having us here today. To my left here is Bill Van Vliet. He's with the Network of Oregon Affordable Housing, and I know he is signed up for some testimony, and we tend to work off of each other here a little bit, so I thought it would be appropriate to have both of us up here. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to Senate Bill 823 and 900. We've provided some information for you, and I'll go through a little bit of a presentation to give you an overview and hopefully help you to answer some of the questions that are before the committee. Let me first start by saying, as Oregon Housing Community Services, we are the administrator of this program. We are neutral on this bill. We recognize that the tax credit discussion has much bigger ramifications, but we do want to be able to be here to provide you information on the purpose and how successful this credit has been. And let me start by saying it has been a very, very successful credit, and we're very pleased with the results that we're able to share with you here today. So on the presentation that I had provided to you, I'll start on page 2, and just to give you a little bit of overview, this is a credit that directly benefits the low-income residents of affordable housing. And I want to stress that very, very much, because as I go through this, you'll see this that there are different parties that are involved in the credit, but ultimately the beneficiary of this is the low-income resident. Currently in law, we have a $17 million total cap that we can have on this credit, and the way we look at this generates $425 million in low-interest rate loans that we will be able to provide for the purposes of developing affordable housing. The way this works is that the OHTC requires lenders to reduce interest rate on their loans to affordable housing developers by 4% for a 20-year term. So basically, it leverages and creates low interest rate capital for the purposes of developing affordable housing. In return, the lender is allowed a 4% credit on the outstanding principal balance of that permanent loan for the next 20 years, which is equivalent to that 4% interest rate reduction. Affordable housing developers are then, with that, required to pass through the full amount of savings from that reduced interest rate loan in the form of rent reductions to the tenants. And this is done in different ways. It could be certainly across the board in all the units. It could be that you're trying to serve a very, very low-income population, so you could be reducing units at a higher level to be able to get to affordability for the lower-income tenants. And then the last thing I should mention here in terms of page two, that as it relates to the credit, it can be carried over for a period up to 5 years for the lender. Moving to page three in terms of who benefits, and as I've already addressed, this is specifically to the tenants. We are required to, the OHTC is required to serve families who are earning less than 80% area median income. But I should say that nearly all the families that we're assisting with OHTC, we're actually serving families that are making 50% area median income below. And in many cases with OHTC, we're able to get to those that are 30% AMI or below. And this is, as most of you know, the very lowest income population. So again, very effective in reaching those low-income residents. Obviously, from a benefit standpoint, we're able to reduce the rents and help families become more stable to be able to pay for other costs, health care, food, etc. One thing I wanted to mention also, that if we just taking 2009 as a case study, we were able to use the OHTC to serve 58.9% to populations of special needs. So these are a variety of frail elderly, people with mental, physical disabilities, farm worker house, well, I'm sorry, that's a different credit, but we're able to provide a variety of different needs for special populations. Moving to page four, in terms of some of our accomplishments, what we've been able to do, since the inception of the OHTC, we've been able to do 363 developments statewide, and that accounts for 13,836 units of affordable housing across the state. And if you refer to the very last page, on page eight, it gives you an idea of where those developments are. It lists all 363 developments and the counties in which they have actually been developed. One specific initiative that I think it's important to address, and I know the legislature has been very involved in helping us with this, is related to the preservation of federally subsidized housing projects. And as many of you may know, we have a variety of projects across the state that are provided with federal rent subsidies through HUD contract. These were units that were financed back in the early 80s, and they ensure that people that are 30% AMI or below are getting affordable housing. This is federal money that is coming into the state. In 2006, we were awarded additional increases in our OHTC to help in this particular initiative, and with a variety of different law changes, we were able to use this tool to help us. I'm happy to say that with OHTC, we've been able to preserve, since 2006, 46 of those developments, of which that equates to 1,809 units. What that means from a money standpoint, that's $220 million of federally subsidies that will remain in this state for the next 20 years. Those contracts were on the brink of expiration. Those affordable housing units and that money could have been lost if we weren't able to come in with these financing tools and other tools to preserve it, get it under new ownership, and keep those contracts in the state for the next 20 years. Just to give you an idea how much it would cost to replace that housing, $361 million. So if we were to have to go out and serve that particular population, which obviously they would need a place to live if those units were to go away, that's the cost that it would be associated with it. One other initiative I should mention around preservation is the preservation of manufactured dwelling parks. And the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has also been very beneficial to us, and we continue to work forward on that initiative, but so far, with OHTC, we've been able to preserve 51 spaces. Moving to page five to give you an idea of the benefits. And this is specific, and I just took a little bit of a case study for you of the 1,230 units that we have been able to do since 2009. what that, and just kind of go through this, break this down. For every dollar that we put in with a tax credit, that creates $25 of low interest rate financing. So with the $1.9 million that we've used since 2009, that's $47.2 million of very low interest rate loans to help fund those 1,230 units. Moving on down in terms of additional benefits, one of the things that we have been successful in showing is the economic benefit and leveraging that you get from affordable housing. We've done a variety of studies to provide the leverage as it relates to that. And when you take that $47.2 million and run it through that model, that's $519 million of economic benefit that is generated. That's through leveraging other money to come to the table as well as the local benefit that it provides. The third point here is the federal subsidies that I had mentioned. And again, some of these units that we have preserved since 2009 have been preservation units. With that $1.9 million, we've kept $144.8 million in the state. And then finally, the last piece I should mention is, again, if those units were to go away, you have to replace those, and the replacement cost related to that is relatively high as well. And I apologize, I had my numbers backwards. The $144.8 million was for replacement cost, and in terms of the $70.2 million, that's how much the federal subsidy that we had in the state, so I apologize for that. Page 6 just gives you a summary of what I just said, and to demonstrate the cost that we put in from a state standpoint and the benefits that were achieved. So all in all, $781 million of total benefits to the state at a $43.8 million cost. I don't know about you, but that seems like a pretty good return from my standpoint. That's $737 million that we've been able to keep here in the state and provide for a benefit.
That's a very neutral statement.
Information only, Mr. Chair. So finally, just to wrap up, Mr. Chair, with a summary of the program strengths, it leverages bank and private investments from communities that we would not otherwise had. 100% of that benefit goes directly to our tenants. It's required by law. We have to show that as a pass-through. It's an extremely efficient program, very easy to operate. It may sound a little complex in terms of working through, but very efficient, very low overhead for the department in terms of administering it. As I already mentioned, there's a huge economic stimulus, economic benefit to the credit. And finally, and most importantly, it benefits our low-income citizens by providing them affordable house to live, and it also provides the needed resources for health care, food, clothing, and other necessities. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation, and happy to take any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Crager. Mr. VanVleet, do you have testimony or are you just here for questions?
I can say a few comments and then be happy to answer questions. Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill VanVleet, and I'm the executive director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, and we're a nonprofit consortium of Oregon banks. We operate a number of different loan funds. We operate statewide. We finance affordable housing projects, multifamily affordable housing projects all over the state. We're here to speak in favor of the extension of the sunset of the OHTC. And even though the sunset is technically a couple years away yet, it's important to extend it today. The affordable housing projects have very long development time frames, and it's very important to put together these very complicated financial packages to know which resources are going to be available and which are not by the time we get to the finish line. And so having that advance notice will be very critical. The OHTC is one of our most successful and powerful tools, provides an efficient way to serve very low-income households, and that leaves them some money by lowering the rents, leaving resources left for other basic needs. It's also a strong tool to leverage private capital, as Rick commented. In one of the handouts in the back, there are some charts in here that really walk you through the math of a couple of different scenarios of how this credit can work. And I won't go into those in detail, but we'll be happy to answer questions if that would be useful. As Rick mentioned, this is an extremely efficient program. It's simple to administer. One of the strongest characteristics of it is that it's not discounted and sold. A lot of tax credits are discounted and sold. This one is not. Every dollar of foregone state revenue goes for a policy benefit by benefiting low-income households. We actually get more than dollar-for-dollar benefit out of this because almost every project that I'm aware of over-delivers because they have their compliance of the program, and they always leave themselves a cushion. So they actually end up reducing rents by more than they have to so that they make sure they comply with the requirements under the program. So that adds to the efficiency. These projects result in investments that create jobs as well as affordable housing. It's both a social and an economic tool. And a recent Center for Housing Policy report studied the role of affordable housing in creating jobs and stimulating local economic development. The report cited a study by the National Association of Home Builders that concluded that building 100 units of affordable housing created more than 120 construction jobs and supports approximately 30 ongoing jobs after these projects are constructed. So we need the sunset now to keep these projects in our pipelines and to keep developing our pipelines. And in closing, this is an important tool for us to address affordable housing, and the extension will help us provide housing to those that are most in need. The state investment will also stimulate significant private investment in the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Question for you, Mr. Van Vliet. So how do we know that the subsidy is actually channeling through dollar for dollar? Is this program audited? Is there a way that the department can determine that?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I will take a crack at that in terms of the question. We are required, as you know, to pass this through, so we have a formula in which we have to determine what the savings is on that particular loan over the course of the 20 years, and then we take that savings and then we have to allocate it out amongst, you know, in the form of rent reductions. We monitor that in terms of our annual compliance process for the department through our asset and property management division, so we have to ensure that is put through. In terms of the Department of Revenue and their audit functions, I'm not aware on what they do.
And then I can add just briefly, when we underwrite loans coming through our organization for approval, we're always looking at, and we're required to look at, these projects with and without this credit. And so we see what the rents would be with the credit and what the rents would be without the credit. And so therefore, we're documenting as well, because the last thing we want is to have money already advanced on a project that discovers they're out of compliance and can't charge the rents that we have anticipated they're going to receive. Because then we'd have a problem with the project being able to pay back its loan. And then the last thing that we do is we need to make sure these projects are going to succeed in their communities in attracting tenants, because tenants have choices. So we make sure that the rents in our projects are well below market rents so that regular market rate projects won't attract the tenants that we're trying to attract at these projects. That's just kind of the business side of what we do. So there's those two processes for making sure the rents are achieving the goals of the program.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add, and I failed to let you know this other stuff that we had provided to you in terms of handout. The 11 questions, I believe, we provided you the answers. We've kind of been through this process already on the House side. So in terms of the information there before you have all the answers to the questions, and as well as some of the additional questions that was asked on the House side, we thought that might be helpful to you as well in terms of making your decision.
Good. Thank you very much. Janet Byrd and Martha McClellan. McClellan. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I am the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternative. We're a nonprofit organization providing affordable housing. Our mission is to create opportunity through housing. And by that, we talk about the opportunity for security, for stability, for dignity. We believe that having housing really provides a foundation for successful life and is critical for successful families and communities. What is being handed out to you is a couple of illustrations of projects where we have used the OAHTC. That illustrate a little bit of the different ways that it can be used and the benefits that accrue to the properties. The first property that I want to talk to you about is the Charleston Apartments. This is a 52-unit building in Wilsonville. 15 of those units are targeted for folks in recovery from mental illness as part of the Villebois redevelopment project. The remainder of the units are targeted for entry-level workers or seniors on fixed incomes. The OHTC in this particular case provided a rent savings of averaging $47 per month per household. The average household income in that property is $1,340 a month. So you can see how meaningful it is. That is probably another prescription or two for residents of those apartments each month. That particular project created 59 jobs that were direct and indirect jobs created through the construction and 16 created by households occupying the property over the course of its life. You can see that the OHTC applied to a first mortgage of just about $700,000. The second project is the Quimby Apartments in Bend. This is one of the preservation projects that Mr. Krager talked about that has the Section 8 rent assistance. In this situation, the OHTC basically leverages an increased amount of private debt for the property rather than providing a rent pass-through because rent assistance is already available to the property from the HUD contract. In this particular case, it provided an additional $550,000 worth of debt that could be used as part of the package for the financing, meaning that we didn't need that money in the form of gap funds from state or local or federal government sources. The value of the Section 8 contract in that case is over $290,000 per year, and the average household income in that property is less than $1,000 per month. I'd be glad to answer any questions. This is a very valuable program for affordable housing developers throughout the state. And we hope that you will extend the sunset. Thank you.
Janet.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships and the Chair of the Housing Alliance. I've submitted written testimony, and so I won't read it. I just wanted to make a couple points in summary. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of cities, nonprofit organizations, housing developers, other interested folks who understand the value of affordable housing in our communities. We feel really strongly that the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit helps us advance the goal of creating and preserving affordable housing. We really strongly encourage you to extend the sunset on this program. I would echo some of the comments that Mr. Van Vliet and Mr. Krager made about the efficiency of the credit. We look closely at the benefits of the credit. One of the handouts that you received is something that we prepared with our partners that shows examples of how the benefit really does pass through to low-income renters in all of the ways that the credit is used. We worked hard in 2007 to make the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit useful in preserving federally assisted subsidized housing as well as manufactured home parks. And so, we also looked closely at where the benefits of that are. So strongly urge your support of the extension of the sunset. Happy to answer any questions that you have. And we appreciate your time today.
Thanks. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Would anybody else like to testify on 823 and Senate Bill 900? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 823 and Senate Bill 900. And I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 573. Patrick, you want to tee this up? And then Rose, could you come forward too and discuss the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Munro.
The tax credit measure that we just heard, doesn't it have to go to the tax credit committee?
That's correct. We have to make a decision.
We're not ready to move it today?
No.
Oh, okay. I am.
Chair.
You got at least one vote.
Senate Bill 573, we heard this a week ago today on the 6th. It's a measure that prohibits health insurers from demanding refund of payment made to satisfy a claim of a health care provider more than 6 months after the date of payment. We have prepared the Dash 1 amendment. Ms. Cox is here to speak to that. We have the paperwork with the Dash 1 amendment. The measure has a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact. So all the paperwork is in hand. I'll let her go ahead and...
Okay. For the record, I'm Rose Cox, representing Ambulatory Surgery Centers. What this Dash 1 amendment does is we've been meeting with the commercial insurers and trying to work out a compromise. This amendment changes the timeline to 9 months for after the date of payment that an insurer would have to notify a provider that they believe that there could be an overpayment or a mistaken payment, and then an additional 15 months beyond that, so 24 months from the date of payment, to negotiate what the difference of payment's going to be and to make the payment back to the insurer. We're still in some conversations trying to decide if this is going to be the absolute final where we can all come together. We're still a little bit apart on our timelines and are really trying to work together. So we would love to see the bill come out of committee today and, you know, on the record, the ASCs and providers in the OMA are still working with insurers and vice versa to try and come together. So we leave it to the will of the committee. Obviously, we'd love to see this come out, and we'll continue working on it both through the Senate floor and on the House side. But if you guys want us to keep working before you pass it out, then that's what we'll do.
And I appreciate that. And some members of the committee have asked if we could, you know, hit the pause button for a little bit to allow the negotiations to go on. I'm just a little concerned with how stacked up we're getting in the bills that we have waiting for us for the next two sessions. So it's my intention, if the majority of the committee agrees with that, to move it to the floor, get this off our docket, and then the negotiations could continue over on the House side.
Absolutely. And like I said, we will even continue negotiations before it even goes to the Senate floor. And be sure to come in touch base with all of you to let you know what we're going to be doing going forward.
Any just questions for Ms. Cox? Okay.
No.
Senator George?
Are we in work session?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 573.
Senator George has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 573. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the Dash 1s? Mm-hmm. So ordered. Senator Bonamici, would you make the motion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 573 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 573 as amended with the Dash 1 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, they're getting a lot closer, and that I do appreciate with all the sides, so on and so forth. I would encourage we move it out of the committee, but I am going to be a no vote, so we're going to ensure that they keep working together to the second it hits the floor.
Okay. To send a message to our good friends.
I'm buying insurance.
Okay.
Because I want them to come to an agreement.
Senator Monroe.
Well, I too would like to thank the parties for working, continuing to work on this important issue. I have always had a policy that I don't like to pass out bills and hope the House will fix them. But I understand the pressures of time, particularly on this committee, so I'll reluctantly support the motion.
Thank you. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I want to echo what the good senator from West Valley said, which is I don't think this bill is quite ready to go. Obviously, the parties are still negotiating, and I think they're close. And perhaps that means that we can win Senator Monroe's vote on the minority report.
Good luck and God bless.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I feel like everyone else has weighed in, so I agree with the comments about the need to keep working on this. It's not quite ready. I, on the other hand, will support moving the bill to the floor and hope they get things worked out.
Further discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
And Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, is there a possible notice of the minority report?
I'm shocked. I am hoping it will not be necessary. Senator Boquist moves
if they get it
notification
out,
of possible minority reports.
That's
right. Tell you what, I will do the committee a favor and carry that bill on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will close the work session on Senate Bill 573, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 908. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 908, we heard this for the first time on Monday. It's the bill that changes the title of Director of Affirmative Action to Director of Diversity and Inclusion. We adopted at that previous meeting the Dash 1 Amendment, which removes the name change for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business and moves the maintaining of the Oregon Opportunity Register and Clearinghouse from the duties of the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business to the duties of the Director of Economic and Business Equity. At the time, we did not have the fiscal impact statement, but we have since received a statement of no fiscal impact, and so we have that plus the no revenue impact for the measure, so the measure is good to move as is, Mr. Chair.
Good. Wonderful. All right, so we are in a work session. Maybe we can all lock arms again on this very controversial bill and get that kumbaya feeling back in our committee.
Don't get your hopes up.
Senator George, would you be willing to make a motion on this?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we're in a work session.
We are.
I move Senate Bill 908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 908 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, in the spirit of your kumbaya statement, I will vote yes and not serve notice of minority.
All right. Any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, you know, I was hoping we would behave like the Senate did yesterday, but it appears that on many of these votes, we're behaving more like the House behaved today, so I don't know.
With one distinction.
We didn't have
any. Yes, I was wondering if Senator Monroe is going to vote half the time with us and half the time with you guys.
All right, Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Senator Boquist, would you please carry this bill?
Delighted, Mr. Chair.
So you guys are going to carry every bill you actually vote for today.
Is that a punishment?
Mr. Chair, we can make a punishment.
Let me take that back. You will carry every bill you don't vote for today. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 908. And let's see. Let's get back into the rough and tumble. You know, Winston Churchill once said, I like a man who smiles when he fights. So why don't we open a work session on Senate Bill 612. Patrick, you want to tee us up and tell us where we are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 612 was previously heard on March 7th and April 11th, which was Monday. This is a bill that requires construction labor contractors to be licensed by the Bowie Commissioner. We had and still have in front of us, Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 Amendment, which exempts labor unions and local joint apprenticeship committees, removes the $102.50 maximum fee for construction labor contractor license, and changes the operative date to July 1st, 2013. The proponents of the measure are in the room if the committee has questions. We have before us the always popular indeterminate fiscal impact statement, which has been provided to the members prior to the meeting, and also a notice of no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, Patrick. And to recall, colleagues, there was a number of bills by the Stop Wage Theft Coalition, and this one seemed to have very little controversy around it. There were no people testifying in opposition. So that being said, we are in work session. Again, I would like to clear our dockets. So, Senator Bonamici, would you feel comfortable making a motion on this?
Mr. Chair, are we adopting the Dash 1 Amendment?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 612.
Senator Bonamici has moved the Dash 1 Amendments to Senate Bill 612. Is there any discussion?
Oh, I just looked at my notes, I believe. Did we already adopt the Dash 1 Amendment? No.
There was if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
There was a motion made at the previous meeting, but the motion was withdrawn.
Thank you. Okay, just clarifying.
Is there any discussion to the Dash 1? Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 612 is amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici has moved Senate Bill 612 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate the Dash 1 amendment because it does change the implementation date out to July 1st, 2013. And so if there are concerns that arise in the implementation, we'll be back again before that happens. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
And Mr. Chair, I still have the concerns about, double registration, and we still have these businesses that are operating illegally, and the Secretary of State isn't doing anything about it, and we're passing the buck to Bolle, so.
Well, I know how much you guys like the Secretary of State.
I got along with Mr. Park yesterday, Mr. Chair. I must admit that.
Any other further discussion? Okay, well, I think the reason that this bill didn't have a whole lot of or no opposition when in testimony is that in many respects it gives a good seal of approval to those type of construction labor contractors who are doing the right thing, and I will be supporting it on that basis. So that being said, we are in work session. The motion has been made, and Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. The motion passes.
Mr. Chair. It's a possible notice in the minority report.
Senator Boquist has given possible notice of a minority report. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 612.
Carry a reminder.
Yes. Senator Bonamici, would you be willing to carry Senate Bill 612?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. And next on the list.
Yes.
All right. I will open work session on Senate Bill 890. Patrick, can you tee us up with the Dash 6 amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Let me shovel a few more trees here. Okay. Senate Bill 890. Thank you. This measure we heard on April 4th, and on Monday, this is the measure that requires contracting agencies to include conditions in public contracts requiring prompt payment of subcontractors or risk of damages or other relief in the contracting agency. We have before us the amendment that was provided that is under consideration, Mr. Chair, the Dash 6 amendment. The Dash 6 amendment removes references to ORS 279B, which I believe Department of Administrative Services had expressed concern about at the hearing we had in the bill on the 4th. So it moves those references. It amends ORS 279C.570 to clarify the duties of contracting agencies in prompt payment of contractors and of contractors in prompt payment of subcontractors, and provides for requirements for elimination and payment of retainage. The measure also makes a small change of the term permitted under the terms of the subcontract to in dispute in Section 3, Sub 4, Sub A, Sub C. With the Dash 6 amendment, the measure has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so we are in work session. I think my point of view in moving this bill is that small business in Oregon can't wait. I think there's been a suggestion that maybe we have a work group that work on this in over the interim, and with many small contractors having to lay off people while they're waiting for retainage, while they're waiting for payment, I just feel like we need to move this forward, and if need be, negotiations could continue over on the House side. So that being said, Senator Bonamici, could you make a motion on this?
For the Dash 6?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 890.
Senator Bonamici has moved the Dash 6 into Senate Bill 890. Is there any objection? Senator Boquist?
No objection.
Okay. No objections to moving the Dash 6. So ordered. Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 890 with the Dash 6 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Right. Senator Bonamici has moved Senate Bill 890 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I mean, this is an ongoing problem both at the state and federal level right now. I'm not sure this is the solution, but
I'm in agreement with the chair that we need to do something to broaden it along, because it impacts, you know, local wage earning guys that aren't getting paid and all the way down the food chain. And while I'm not declaring a conflict of interest, I'm experiencing a very similar thing at the federal level in this very moment. So I'm quite sympathetic to those individuals who are being, shall we say, not taken care of appropriately by the prime contractor. So I'll be supportive of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I'll be voting no on the bill. I see the problem. There's no doubt about it. But we're interfering with a contractual relationship at this point. And from my perspective, the folks that brought us the bill needed to go out and seek those who opposed the bill and try to work something out for us. And really what I saw was is that we left the instruction that they should work together, and then nobody worked together. And so the people who are advocating for the bill have the burden, from my perspective, to try to work on something. And just not working on something doesn't get us to where we are. And for me to interfere in a contractual relationship between two private businesses without kind of a public reasoning why I would interfere with that, I have a real difficult time, especially since there was no negotiation that went on this bill, to go forward and vote for this bill. So I hope that negotiations continue as it goes over the House, because I see the problem. I'm just not sure that us taking sides in this at this point with this type of policy is necessarily the right decision.
And Mr. Chair, I share the concerns of both the members who have spoken. I think this is a discussion that's not quite complete. I will give a courtesy vote, but I don't know where I'll be when by the time it gets to the floor.
Okay, fair enough. Good. Any further discussion?
How much for Cuba? All right. Yeah, I can work like the House every day.
Debbie, please call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shute?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries, and I will carry that bill on the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 890. And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 944. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 944 is the bill that prohibits OLCC from imposing minimum amount requirements for liquor purchases. At the previous meeting on Monday, we adopted the Dash 3 Amendment that specified that single container purchases must be a valuable or value of $30 or greater, but allows for adjustment of that $30 value by the CPI, the Portland, Salem, Oregon, Washington region. Specifies that single purchases must be a brand available through the U.S. distributor, doesn't acquire more than a single case in a transaction, be purchased by OLCC, must be an item not regularly stocked by the commission, and requires the special orders be for 750 milliliter containers if they're available in that size. With the Dash 3 amendment, the measure has a minimal fiscal impact, and the first for me, a minimal revenue impact as well.
Okay.
So the bill's ready to go, Mr. Chair.
And as far as you know, OLCC and the proponents are both satisfied.
These are OLCC's amendments, Mr. Chair, and they met the satisfaction of the person who came to testify in support of the bill on the day we had the hearing.
Okay. Good. We are in work session. Senator George, feel comfortable making a motion on this?
Yeah.
No, wait, we need to move the Dash 3.
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, we adopted the Dash 3.
We did. Okay. Okay. We're just waiting for the paperwork.
So 944, right?
Yes.
How come the bill that we're all unanimous on is one about drinking? Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 944 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 944 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just note that there's one Democrat senator and two Republican representatives on here, so.
That's right. Are you saying that the Senate Republicans
are teetotalers?
This is a bipartisan
Kumbaya. This is how the House is supposed to work, right, Senator Monroe?
We're supposed to, but they didn't.
Further discussion? Could you please call the roll, Debbie?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair
Shield? Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator George, would you carry that one?
I will.
All right. The Booze Bill of 2011. let's see.
The only one left, Mr. Chair, is 294.
All right.
It's the only one that you haven't carried over already. So.
Okay. Let's stand at ease for a second.
I've been trying to read on my bill.
Okay. We open the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee on April 13th.
Okay.
Colleagues, we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 294. Patrick, can you tell us where we are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 294, we heard this on April 4th. We go Monday. The measure changes the methods by which landlords may bill tenants for utilities or services. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. We have folks in the room who can address questions if the committee has questions. In the meantime, the measure has a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact statement. We have received, and I put in your packets for your perusal, a piece of testimony from Paul Brewer, legislative chairman of the Oregon Partial Owners Alliance, in opposition to the measure. And that's where we stand, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why don't we have, Sybil, would you feel comfortable coming up and just kind of tell us where we're at?
Sybil or John.
John. Okay.
He's hiding. He's hiding in the corner.
And you might as well bring Chuck up, too, so they can sing goodbye off.
You want a chair in between you just in case?
Can the chair serve notice of the minority report?
We're having a good time. I want to tell you
when to get that up.
You can.
Mr. Chair, Paul Brewer
is here. Is that what Ringo did way back then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. And you're being given my written testimony from April 4th, in which I described this bill and what we expect the bill to look like once the amendments are completed. They are not completed. And I've hand-marked it to show you a change, a significant change. The bill that came from the coalition had four issues in it. One of those four issues has to do with what I've called opportunity to purchase, for the residents to purchase a manufactured home park. Other people, landlords, I refer to as right of first refusal. There has been significant objection to that among landlords, and so we have agreed to remove that issue from the bill. That is the subject of the opposition testimony that you received from Paul Brewer, I believe. I wasn't given a copy of that, but I think that's what his testimony was about. So the bill's incomplete. We're asking you to move it. The amendments are not back from Legislative Council, and we're concerned about the deadline. I know you don't like doing that. This is not an issue that does not require. This is an issue that does not require further negotiation. We've done the negotiation. We've negotiated longer than I want to negotiate, and we've taken out the one controversial issue. I believe that the remaining issues have the support of the coalition. I'll ask Chuck to address that. We just need the drafting to get done. We will do that on the House. It will come back to you, and you'll see the detail. I can talk about the detail in greater detail if you want, but it's small detail and complicated.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I'm assuming what you're saying is it's going to take a while for them to get the LC drafting done?
Senator Shields and Senator Monroe, that is correct. I have actually, what we agreed to in the coalition was an outline of elements, 3 to 4 pages or 6 pages on each of the four issues that we worked on. And it's the subjects are complicated, and LC had trouble doing that. So I am now drafting it in LC form and then working with LC to make sure that it gets done.
Mr. Chair.
So we're hired.
I just wanted to, as someone who's participated in several of the coalition meetings, I want to say that John has worked very hard, and Sybil, especially John and Sybil, have worked very hard with Legislative Council since before session. So it isn't the proponents or the opponents of the bill who are the issue. It's just trying to get everything back in the right form.
But if I might, I think I bear a large part of the blame for not getting it done earlier. So I wish I had. I think we wouldn't be in this boat if I had.
We'll cut you some slack. All right, any further discussion? We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I just didn't know if you want to ask Mr. Brewer to come up and say anything since he's here, if he wants to explain, just so that everything is clear, that the portion of the bill that he's objecting to is not in this now. Do you want to say anything, Paul? I just want everybody to be clear that the way I understand it is that the portion that you're objecting to is the opportunity to purchase, and that is not in the current bill that we're voting on. So that everything's clear, I just want to give you that opportunity to.
Senate Shields.
Greenfield and the rest of the committee. Yes, my name is Paul Brewer. I am executive director of or chair of the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, and what John has stated basically is correct. Our only objection to this bill was the first right to purchase. We are in consensus for the sub-meter and the other items that are still in the draft mode that will hit the House on the other issues that have yet to be completed. So we are on the same page at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, we are in work session. We have no... Oh, Chuck, do you want to say anything on the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We've worked with Paul and with John here over the last, well, since October 2009. We're satisfied with the two issues that we've reached agreement on. We could not reach agreement on the right to the first refusal or opportunity to purchase, and we're satisfied we have these two issues, and we are confident we can reach it. An agreement in the House to move these other two. So appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you.
All right, Senator George. Is there any amendments?
Nope, just
okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 294 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moved Senate Bill 294 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Monroe?
Well, once again, I'd like to thank John and Chuck in particular and Sybil for their good, long, and hard work. I wish the amendments were all prepared so we could send a nice, clean bill over the House, because watching them today, I'm not sure I can trust them to treat any bill right, but I'm sorry.
Taking it personally
today? Yeah, taking it personally. Those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, yesterday the Senate passed, I carried the education bills, and the Senate passed them 30-0. Today, on the House side, it was 32-28, so after 2 hours of yakking. So anyway, thank you once again, John and Chuck in particular, Sybil, for your good work, and keep it up.
Can I
Senator Boquist.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, Chair, I do want to thank him. I mean, these coalition bills come forward, and they're always great to see everybody agreeing. Like Senator Monroe, I have challenges in having, you know, come from the House more recently. I'm less faithful than he is. And I just bought an insurance policy at the beginning of this committee, and I'm very supportive of this. I agree 110% with it. But just for the record, I will be a no here, a no on the floor, and a yes when it comes back for conference committee report. So but I'm very supportive of it, and I will lend my support behind it.
Okay.
Can I just want to clarify, Mr. Well, Chair?
Are there
no amendments?
I used to be one.
We're done.
I was there once.
That are ready? Just as is. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
As you've heard me earlier, I really hate to send bills out incomplete, but because the coalition has done such a good job and has a track record, at least with me, all of you do, that this is, I trust everybody who negotiates this. So I'm assuming this is going to be workable going across, and so I appreciate that, and I'll be voting yes. But I just want to make sure that we all stay exactly how we're saying we're going to do it. So.
Good. Fair enough.
I think they will. This is the other side I'm worried.
Yeah, it's
so awesome. Motion has been made. I can recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is there any further discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Brian Meachie?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Monroe and Senator Bonamici, would you be willing to co-carry this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Put in a little work for the committee. All right. Before we adjourn, I want to put on the record that we are carrying over every single other bill that we did not take action on today.
Okay.
That'll cover.
And Senator George asks where we are on Senate Bill 41. Actually, yeah, you want to give us an update?
Yeah. Colleagues, the chair has graciously allowed me to...
Do you need to open a work session on it? Or no, you can't. It's not on the agenda.
It is on the work session. It is on the agenda.
Oh, it is on the agenda.
Sorry. Just an update.
You're right. It is on the agenda.
Yeah, we're
sorry,
fine.
Go ahead.
Just calendaring, I guess.
I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 41, Senator George.
The chair has graciously allowed me to abuse his staff and bring them into some negotiations on Senate Bill 41. We have I think, successfully at least gotten some framework from local governments, school special districts, state agencies, and the Attorney General on an agreement on the public records request law changes. Probably doesn't go as far as the AG wanted, and probably goes a little further than a lot of the local governments wanted us to go. But I think we're getting very close. We have some final amendments that are going to be, should be in our offices in the next 24 hours. We're going to send those out, and our hope and expectation is that we will be ready to move something on Monday. I'm guessing this is going to continue to be negotiated as it moves across, but I think we're going to be sending out a product that we can be proud that they could go to state law as is. But I basically said, once it moves here, I don't really, I mean, keep talking. So that's where we are on Senate Bill 41. I think we're making a lot of progress, and I appreciate the chair's latitude in letting us work on this.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate your work, and appreciate my staff, Mary Alicia Briggs, who's in the audience, for putting up with Senator George. So I will close a work session on Senate Bill 41, and again, we are rolling over every single bill that we have not taken action on today. And we are adjourned.
That's always